Houston, Texas. This is KPFT-FM, FMHD1, Houston.
Pacifica owned and listener supported for over 50 years. This is 90.1 KPFT and FMHD1, Houston.
It's 5 p.m. Thursday, and it's time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubichek, producer and tonight's host, and every week, along with the best crew on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their soul. You know, KPFT is pretty excited about moving into its new home on Caroline before the end of the month, and the move is going to shake up our programming schedule just a bit. Our show, So What's Your Story, is going to be moving to 6 o'clock Wednesday, starting September 28th. This is great news for local tellers, but you know, even in the studio, So What's Your Story will continue to reach out to storytellers all over the country who captivate this Texas region with memorable tales. Today, we'll again prove my point because my guest teller will be launching his stories from Dallas. I met him when I was a contestant in a storytelling contest hosted by the Dallas Storytellers Guild, of which my guest, Michael Bundy, serves as president. Michael, along with me, serves on the board also of the Tejas Storytelling Association. He was born in Leavenworth, Kansas. He received a BA in social science from Emporia State University and a master's degree in business from Lindenwood College in St. Charles, Missouri. But you know, like most intuitive people, he says that his most valuable lessons come from life, laced with the wisdom from elders and teachers. Retiring after 39 years at AT&T without missing a single day of work as a technical director, Michael invested in his community, ranging from role as guardian angel to volunteering with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, just to name a few. But you know, it was the time he took to cultivate his passion for the spoken word, thanks to his membership in the National Speakers Association and Toastmasters International Hall of Fame, that gave him the tools for inspiring others. He's an author and he's president of his company, I Speak. Now, there's a lot more to Michael Bundy on our Facebook page, so please check it out. But right now, let's talk about why he's there. Because, you know, of all the fantastic reasons to tell stories, Michael, in my judgment, effortlessly taps into the most important. Because we're born a blank page, and every page should document the treasures, those moments frozen in time, which ultimately validate who we are. Simply put, our story is our life, and our life is our story. Michael, how you doing? I'm so glad you're here, right?
Doing great, Hank. It's a good day.
It's Zoom, but we'll pretend that we're like feet away. Well, you know, I didn't like Zoom at one time, but you know what? It's kind of a good thing.
I think it's a good piece of technology.
We do things like this, right? Yeah. We spent decades in IT, speaking of technology. And then you joined Toastmasters, if I remember correctly, and your role changed. At what point did you realize that effective storytelling is needed to fully fuel a successful speaker?
Well, for me, Hank, I think I always knew that I enjoyed communicating, whether that was giving speeches, telling stories, debating, writing, any way of communicating was a good thing for me. And even when I was working at AT&T, And that was when it was Southwestern Bell, then it became SBC, and then later on it became AT&T. Even then, I still liked the idea of speaking, and I would have loved to have quit my day job and just do nothing but speak and tell stories. But I had a really good job, and they were paying me pretty good, and I wasn't sure I could hustle that way and make enough money to, if I was just speaking. But I think if it's something that you like, then you do it. So what I did was I kept speaking, and I spoke and I spoke and I spoke. I spoke everywhere I could around the company, at departmental meetings and staff meetings. I joined not one, but, you know, several Toastmaster clubs so that I could learn how to speak. And what I found out is that speaking, and if you're going to be a good speaker, you got to tell stories. And, you know, telling stories is what gets people's attentions. It's right. A good way to inform people, to inspire people, to entertain people, to do all those kinds of things. So that's what got me started. And now I decided, well, if I want to be a good storyteller, I better find out about these storytelling guilds. Right. And that's when I got into the Dallas Storytelling Guild and the North 40 Storytelling Guild.
Smart, real smart, smart. You know, today's stories that you're going to tell are inspired by history. But let's start with the story surrounding your decision to attend college.
Well, for me, back in my day, it wasn't that difficult to decide whether you're going to go to college or not. There weren't a lot of good choices. The bad choice would be to go into the service and go into Vietnam. And that was something that I didn't want to do. So even though all the men in my family had a military career, that turned out not to be the case for me. I was really good in ROTC and I had ROTC scholarships. But back in those days, right about the time I was a junior or senior was when they had Kent State and they were burning ROTC buildings on campus. And plus, I wasn't really a fan of the war. So I was fortunate. I had a wrestling scholarship and I had academic scholarships and I went to school on those. But I always had a love for the military and people in the military. I grew up, every male in my family is in the military but me. Going back to my great grandfathers, my great uncles, my father, my uncles, my brothers, even my nephews, everybody. So I can't talk the vernacular with them, the acronyms and stuff, but one of my lucky things was when I was growing up, there was a barbershop real close to the base, ran by a guy named Sergeant Litton, who was an old Buffalo soldier. And he would have all the military guys come down to his barbershop. And at Fort Leavenworth has the Command and General Staff College. So if you're going to go above the rank of major, you come there to go to college. So all the black officers would come there to go to, quote, college. And they would come to his barbershop because he was an ex-soldier. And he would put their pictures on the wall and they would tell fabulous stories. And they're the ones who got me interested in ROTC in the first place and later into the military. And even though I didn't get into the military, I was fascinated with those heroes. And even now, those heroes that people don't hear about and don't know about, but there's a lot of cool military guys. And if you give me a moment, let me tell you about real short three guys that I think people would be interested in. They just happen to be Navy, even though most of my family's in the Army. But one would be Dory Miller. Now, a lot of people have heard about Dory Miller because Dory Miller made the big time with the media. He was a mess man. Now, in World War II, black men didn't get a chance to serve in a lot of different ways in the navies. And a lot of times they were what they'd call mess men. And a mess man would be someone who worked in the kitchen, worked in the laundry, or maybe someone who provided like valet services for an officer or whatever. But they weren't trained in gunnery or any of those kind of things. Well, Dory Miller was at Pearl Harbor on December 7th for Pearl Harbor Day. He was on the West Virginia carrier. Now, his boat got bombed and it was big fire and everything was going on. And Dory was downstairs. He had just finished serving breakfast. And he rushes up to the top deck and sees all this mayhem and helps out the officers and the people that have been injured, pulls them down to safety. And then he rushes back up. Now, they have a great movie about this. And it shows how he rushed back up to the deck, found a machine gun that wasn't being occupied. And he began to just blast away at the Japanese airplanes, trying to protect and save his men. And he did just that. And Dory Miller, like I said, he's kind of well known. He received the Navy Cross for bravery for doing that. But then there's this other guy who's not quite as well known. His name is Elvin Bell. Now, Elvin was also a mess man again, too. He served on the USS Lexington out in the Pacific. And once they were in a battle with the Japanese, and their ship, of all the ships, gets hit by a couple of torpedoes, a couple of bombs. I mean, it's just blasted apart. Terrible fires everywhere. But deep, 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 deep in the bottom of the ship, several decks below, It's a massive fire, and a lot of some of the men are trapped down there. Well, they have to make a decision. Are we going to go help them, go save them? And Elvin Bell's the guy who volunteers to go. And if you can envision, he goes down the first deck, and there's nothing but fire and smoke, and another deck, and another deck, and there's explosions all around. He finally gets to the bottom of the ship and has to go through all types of barriers, and he can hear the men wailing out. And he finally gets there and pulls away and opens the door, finds these injured men, and carries them back up the same path through the fire, through all that heat and smoke where you can hardly see, and brings them out to safety. Now, Elvin Bell, he got a little bit of notoriety, and he received the Navy and Marine Corps Medal for Bravery, which was pretty cool because that was a pretty big deal. And there again, it was another mess guy whose normal job wouldn't be nothing like that. But my favorite story, my favorite one, is a guy named Charles Jackson French. Now, not a lot of people hear about Charles Jackson French. Charles Jackson French, he was in the Navy before the war, got out of the Navy, and then came back as a result of Pearl Harbor. He re-enlisted. Well, he was on a ship the ship was called the USS Gregory. And the USS Gregory was involved in this big old battle, and his ship was like sunk. All the guys on the ship and everything just sunk. And this guy who works as a mess man, first thing he does, he pulls 15 different sailors out of the ocean and put them in a life raft, okay? Saves these 15 injured guys. Then the boat is starting to drift toward the shore. Well, if they make it to the shore, the Japanese are there. Then they're going to be Japanese POW captain. And that wasn't a cool thing to do. So what he did was he tied a rope around his waist and had the guys on the boat, and he tugged that raft. They called him the human tugboat. With the rope around his waist, he tugs that boat through shark-infested waters throughout the night for 8 hours. 8 hours swimming, pulling 15 guys. I can't even imagine what that's like. And they say that the men would stand there and holler when sharks would come and fight off the sharks. Well, Charles's story was big in the black press back home, but it wasn't too big in the white press, in the main media. Matter of fact, when he came back home, he would go to historical black college football games, and they would have him come out at halftime, and they would talk about how heroic he was. But one day, his guy that was on the ship, one of the white officers, he told this story to his daughter. His daughter leaked it to the regular media, and then it became a big story, and him known as being the human tugboat. But whereas the other guys, they got, you know, distinguished crosses and special medals, all Charles French Jackson got for doing all that swimming was a letter of certification saying, thank you for your service. We're glad. He died a few years later, in his 30s, and he wasn't very well known at that time, but he was definitely one of those people that I would call a hero, and reminds me of those stories that I used to hear in the barbershop from those old military guys about what black men were doing in the service. So that's how I got to college, avoided the military, but still maintained a fantastic love for the military and military stories.
Wow, what a great story. What a great story. And that really unfolded with a lot of imagery, and I really saw it. My how do you fight off sharks? My God. You know, there's a lot of implications about what a hero is in your story, but I know it's going to be hard to do in about 30 seconds, but what is the recipe for a hero based on these narratives that you just offered? In other words, how would you summarize it and say, these guys are heroes, and here's why?
Well, I think the recipe for a hero is someone who takes selfless action. You know, one who's willing to go into harm's way to help others with little regard for his own safety. Heroes do what they do because they want to help other people. They don't care about getting in the news or the headlines or the paparazzi or any of that. They're the ones who run toward danger. You know, you hear it a lot in the news nowadays, the policemen, the firemen who hear the shots or hear the fire, but when all the rest of us are running, getting away, they're the ones who are running toward that danger. Right. That's a true hero to me, especially the ones who do it selflessly without any. They don't care about being notarized or getting on newspapers or in the news.
No, that's it. I mean, you know, humbleness, selflessness, that is it. Absolutely. That's a common denominator. These kind of stories are fascinating because I think the world, especially kids, I'm not trying to criticize millennials, but they need to understand what heroes really are. You know, historically framed stories require significant research, and your next story sort of punctuates that point. This story spotlights the summer of 1816. That's all I'm going to say. Share it with us.
Well, one thing that I like to do is I like historical stories. And I like historical stories because they remind me that things aren't always as bad as they seem to be even right now. They probably have been just as worse, if not, or in the past. And that's how I got to this story about 1816. It starts off with a guy named Reverend Williams. Reverend Williams was a minister in New England. And he particularly lived in Bethel, Vermont. And at that time in New England, all the ministers were traveling ministers. They'd be at one church on one Sunday, and they'd be at another church the next Sunday, and another church the following Sunday. All of them traveled. Well, Reverend Williams had been doing this for 20, 30 years, and getting to be a little old man, Reverend Williams said, I'd like to just have one building, one church. And he went to the congregation and he asked, well, would you guys be willing to just, you know, build me one church and I can quit all this traveling around? And the congregation, they weren't really too down for that idea. They kind of liked the idea of having a traveling minister, and they weren't into building any big churches. They had other things. But that winter, things seemed to turn and go Reverend Williams' way. So it was the winter of 1815, and the winter of 1815 was a typical winter. It was kind of cold, but it wasn't too wet. And, you know, the months of December and January went by, and we moved into the new year, and it was still just cold and wet. And as January, February, they turned to spring, well, the weather didn't quite break up in New England. It stayed cold and wet and real foggy, you know? And people were starting to get a little concerned. It came springtime, time to plant the crops, and it was just too cold, too wet, and too muggy to plant crops. So the people said, well, you know, we'll wait, and maybe a little later on in the spring, we'll get a chance to plant crops. And they did just that, but it still was unsuccessful because it stayed so cold. In 1816, that year, in June in New England, they got 3 feet of snow. Can you imagine that? 3 feet of snow. And it was cold like that all over the country, all the way down to Savannah, Georgia. In June of 1816, they had frost on the ground. That year, we celebrated all over the country, the 4th of July, indoors because it was too cold to be outdoors. There seemed to be an unending fog that just lingered around the whole country, and it never would dissipate. It just was like that. And it was so bad that people started thinking, well, they had to move and they had to go to warmer places. People started moving and leaving New England and heading west. 15,000 people left Vermont in the year of 1816. So many people moved to Indiana that Indiana became a state in 1816. And 2 years later, Illinois became a state. All as a result of people moving out of New England, trying to get away from that darn cold. It was just miserable. And it wasn't just in the U.S., not North America. It was the same thing everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. In England, the same thing. Ireland, the same thing. In Ireland, it was so cold and so wet and so nasty that potatoes wouldn't even grow. And Irish people, for the first time, migrated to the U.S., one of their first migrations. It was so cold, even in Germany, that wheat wouldn't grow. But they had potatoes, so they started making potato bread. And people from Germany would move to Western Russia, trying to get away from this cold, cold weather. Even Asia, Russia, all that Northern Hemisphere, the monsoons were offset, so the rains didn't come at the right time. And all of a sudden, we had less food, and the little food that was there, of course, the prices went up. So now we've got all kinds of inflation, and it's just too expensive all around the planet. And now you've got diseases, cholera, and everything else that come when you have a bad environment like that. 1816 was a terrible year for most everyone in the Northern Hemisphere, and nobody knew why. But the reason was, in April 5th in 1815, on a little small island in Indonesia, a mountain called the Tambora Mountain had just exploded. It started off just being small sparks. And as the days went by, those sparks became big flames going up into the sky. And by the 15th, after 10 days of that, they say that soot and smoke and sulfur was going 25 miles up into the atmosphere, to the stratosphere. From this one mountain, 2/3 of the mountain was blown away. 100,000 people on that island were immediately killed, and all the vegetation immediately was destroyed on that day from that island. They call it the Western Pompeii. So many people died and so much soot went in the air. Well, on the planet, we have what we call supervolcanoes. And supervolcanoes are volcanoes that are located in a certain place on the planet. If you go 30 degrees below the equator and 30 degrees below the equator, that's where those volcanoes set. And when they go off and all that soot goes in the air, they're in the perfect place for all the trade winds to send that soot all over the planet. And without the mass communication and all the great things that we have today, nobody knew what was going on and why the sky was so clouded and the sun couldn't get through. Now, that turned out to be a really good deal for old Reverend Williams. Because see, those people in Vermont, they either thought God had left them and forsake them, or they got the Holy Spirit and got as religious as you could possibly be. And they built Reverend Williams the biggest, the most sturdiest church that you could possibly have. And 208 years from that point, that church still stands in Bethel, Vermont. It's the Bethel United Church of Vermont. Reverend Williams, hey, he saw some tough times, but I always say if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at can change. And that's the story.
That is a great
of 1816.
I love that. I love that. You know, it's interesting because sometimes we take a look at traditional stories like folk tales and fables, things that help us understand customs and traditions. We don't always take a look at personal stories fueled by history to do kind of the same thing. And that's what you're doing. We understand things better through these historically enveloped personal stories. I know that our listeners can't watch you gesture, but you know, gestures work as punctuation marks. I just want listeners to know that you know, Michael is a great, great deliverer, and his gestures just complement the things that he says so passionately and so beautifully. Wish you could see it, but hey, that's radio, right? That's radio. What are you gonna do? That's radio. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story? With my guest storyteller, Michael Bundy, only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. You know, Michael, I was mentioning earlier that he's really into the spoken word, and I want listeners to know that, you know, speaking and writing are different. If you write something poorly and you give it to me, I can stick it in my desk drawer, and even if it's not written well, I can read it a bunch of different times and eventually get the sense of what you're trying to say. But you know, when people speak, they can only say it once. They got to be able to craft it and mold it well. And that in part, I think, is why there's such a resurgence in storytelling, because we understand that great stories aren't simply dispensed. They are molded like clay and they require some serious learning. And here's the segue, lucky for us, there are some fun and productive ways to make that happen. For example, our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a terrific place to tell stories and really meet the nicest people around. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And consider joining. I can't talk money on Pacifica, but you can probably find the annual dues in the cracks of your sofa. The next story swap is September 27th. Just visit their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to the swap and all of their other story swaps. And also, while I'm mentioning it, all of our shows on So What's Your Story are also loaded on that site. So if you ever miss any, why would you want to miss the show? But if you perhaps do, you can always catch it on their site. the day after it is aired. And since the president of the Dallas Guild happens to be right in front of me, I'm going to ask him to tell us a little bit about how to track them down.
Hey, Hank, appreciate that. The Dallas Storytelling Guild, we meet the second Wednesdays of each month from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And we meet at the in Dallas at the C.C. Young. It's a place called The Point on the campus of the C.C. Young. It's over near the White Rock Lake for people who are in the Dallas area. We meet in person and we meet via Zoom. Matter of fact, we've got members who join us from Taiwan, from Canada, from New Mexico, Seattle, East Texas. And you can find us on the Facebook page also.
Right.
So with that meeting, we're, like I said, we're in person and we're in Zoom. But remember I said I'm in two guilds?
Right.
Well, the North 40 Guild, that's the other one, the North Storytelling Guild. Well, that one is on the third Monday of each month, and that's up in Plano, Texas, 7 o'clock, and we meet at the Heritage Farmstead on 15th Street. If people want to go, they can find us on Facebook, but I don't have a problem with anybody contacting me at mjbrundy@gmail.com.
And also, Michael, please send me that information. I'll be happy to distribute it on our Facebook page as well, right?
We'll do.
Storytellers have to help each other. We're a weird group, but a friendly group, and we got to love each other and help each other, right? Got to do that. Thank you. You know, also, you can take your skills to the next level by joining the Tejas Storytelling Association and or the National Storytelling Network. And also, if you're looking for a great date night or have no date and just want a fun night, our friends at The Moth are packing them into Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. Michael, you know, lots of our listeners say things like, I want to tell stories, but I don't have any to tell. I'm leading a boring life. What do you tell them?
I think there's many types of stories that you can tell. Now, for me particularly, I like personal stories and like historical stories, but there's all kinds. You can tell ghost stories. You can tell fairy tales, folk tales, medieval tales. Biblical tales, one of my favorite kinds that I found out are called the poor case stories. You know, the what is stories? Like, why does a rabbit have a short tail? Why is there a man in the moon? I mean, you can find stories about anything. I like historical stories and I eat footnotes. So when I see something, I go read the footnotes and that leads me down a rabbit hole. But everybody has a story because, I mean, that's what our lives are about. And personal stories for me are the best because they resonate because all of us are pretty much the same. So when I tell a personal story, it'll relate to another person because if it's about courage, they face some of the same things. So I really do believe that all of us have a story. And there's no, you don't have to tell a perfect story the perfect way either.
No. And you know, what you say is very profound. I also like to tell people that there's a range of stories. So for example, even with personal stories, you know, some people think, well, I've got to tell a story about loss or death or something very dramatic in order to make it a story. But they range. You remember the story that I told at the Dallas Guild about my grandfather's soul leaving his body. Mm-hmm. I tell that story often, but I also tell stories about this guy who I said good morning to every day. And if you didn't say hello to him, he'd be upset with you and he'd fight with you, argue with you. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but you know, that's a ritual. And that story meant a lot to me because growing up, we learned to have manners. We learned to say hello to people. We learned to be polite. And there's also a parable in every story. There's some kind of lesson. And we don't have to make it clear to our listeners what they are. When you tell a story well and you like it, like your stories are passionate, we figure out what the story is about. We figure that out. Your next story is based on something that is sadly true. Many of us, as an educator, I know it's true, unfortunately. Many of us don't know much about the history behind the crafting of the amendments to our Constitution. And you make a point with an interesting case study.
Oh, yeah. I love history. And I don't think you can just know it. I think, again, digging down to those footnotes and eating those footnotes. So for me, I've read the Declaration of Independence a number of times. I've read the Constitution a number of times. It's amazing to me that we have 27 grievances in the Declaration against that monarch, the king. And we also have 27 amendments in the Constitution. But it's amazing to me how we how we come up with those and how we live by those, but we know very little about the history of the Constitution, the amendments, or any of that. And part of being a good American, I think, is knowing that. And part of being a good storyteller, I think, is finding a way to tell that story so more people get interested and want to know more about the country. What really gets me right now, Hank, is I've got my grandson living with me, and he's in his 20s, and he's going to college. He's studying American history, and his history that he's studying, he's learning it from a 40-year-old, but he's talking about my life, and that's just amazing to me. But they talk about the 60s and the 70s, and we forget about all the good things that happened, and a lot of things happened. One thing that I like is the story of a man named Birch Bayh. Now, people may not know Birch Bayh. They may know his son more because his son was a senator and a governor recently. But Birch Bayh was a young senator and first elected out of Indiana in 1962. Now, the thing about Birch Bayh that gets me is he shows the difference that one man can make. See, when we got the Constitution was just a way of how we're going to govern ourselves, how we're going to interact with each other as far as the states would go. But there was one man, who became president, James Madison, and said, wait a minute. This all this government stuff, but what about the people? What about the individual people? Well, he wrote up the Bill of Rights. Hence, we got those first 10 amendments to say, hey, that things are going to go cool for the individuals. Well, he wrote more amendments than anyone else, and Birch Bayh comes in second. A guy in 1960s and 1970 wrote two different amendments. See, when Birch was elected to senator, as a young senator, they put him on the Judiciary Committee. And the Judiciary Committee had a subcommittee that he was on that was called the Amendment Subcommittee. Well, the guy who was the chair, he died. So the chair of the whole Judiciary Committee said, we don't need that subcommittee. You know, we haven't been doing nothing with amendments for the past few decades anyway. So let's do away with it. Birch Bayh said, wait a minute. He said, look, I will pay for the committee and the staff out of my own Senate budget if we keep the committee. So that's cool. So they agreed. And here's what he did. See, when President Eisenhower had been president in his second term, he had been sick a lot. And they'd had a lot of problems about Vice President Nixon taking over and how does that work. It got even worse when President Kennedy got assassinated. Because we move up the vice president, but who becomes vice president? How do we handle that succession? That's what the 25th Amendment is about. Birch Bayh is the one who wrote that amendment and got it to pass. Then the other one is that my favorite amendment is the 26th Amendment. See, Hank, I'm not sure your age, but when I was a young man, we were really fussing because 18-year-olds had to go fight in the war, but they couldn't vote. And we fussed about that. And finally, Birch Bayh wrote the 26th Amendment that says 18-year-olds have the right to vote.
I have to interrupt you for a moment. Michael, uh-huh. I'm the oldest person you know. So don't worry about it. I got it.
Well, if that's the case, then you know that he did that in 72. Uh-huh. And as we know that, those of us who used to have to worry about being drafted, well, by 74, the war was over because, like I try to tell young people, voting matters and voting counts. And when we as 18-year-olds got a chance to vote, they got concerned about our vote and got concerned about us being concerned about the draft. And we got rid of the draft so that now we have a volunteer army. That was the power of voting. That came with Birch Bayh. That came during those 60s and the 70s. Not only did he do that, well, Birch was also a product of his time. So he was kind of male chauvinist at first, okay? And there was his wife, Marvella, got cancer. And she wanted to go out and talk about women's issues and that kind of stuff. And Birch said, well, you know, that might impact my senatorial thing. And he kind of, you know, he was on the wrong track. But later on, he came to his senses and said, well, you know, women do have rights and do need rights. He ended up writing the ERA amendment, which passed the Congress and the Senate and got passed 30 some odd states and just about was ratified. This one guy, not only did he work on the ERA amendment, but he worked on and passed Title IX of the Higher Education Act. Now, I'm not a big fan of Title IX, I am now, but it cost me my wrestling scholarship when I was in college because we got rid of those men's sports because Title IX says that we had to spend the same money on female sports as we do for women's men's sports. So for me, it meant we got rid of our wrestling program, but we got a great volleyball and women's basketball teams out of that. But all of that was done as a result of Birch Bayh, one guy writing that much legislation and getting that much stuff through. Now, one of my favorite pieces that he did is one that people don't talk about anymore. But, you know, we've got this thing called the Electoral College that maybe a lot of folks don't know how it works, but it's an old thing from way, way, way back when. And it goes along with the Constitution, and that's how we count people to get representation for Congress versus getting two people for each in the Senate. And it goes back also to being able to count slaves who couldn't vote, but could be counted as 3/5 of a person. All of that confusion is in Electoral College. Well, 700 times in America's history, we've tried to repeal that Electoral College. And 700 times, it has failed. In 68, Birch Bayh got it through the House and Congress, got it all the way to the Senate. 80% of Americans were for it. Now it's kind of like 65, but 80-some percent were for it. He got it that far. And then the Southern Democrats, the Dixiecrats, as they call them, they filibustered and it didn't go anywhere. But, you know, if we didn't have to deal with that Electoral College and we went one man, one vote, like that would have made it. It would have changed the outcome from Gore, Bush, and we may not have had the Iraq War. I don't know. It would have changed the outcome of Clinton and Trump, and we may not have had the confusion that we've had, and we may have had a woman president by now. I don't know. I know that this one guy stuck his neck out to come up with that much legislation. And I just think it's amazing that one senator does that much and we know so little about him. He did one more thing I want to tell you about. And that was when Senator Kennedy ran for office against Carter, he came out in favor of Carter and the whole country was in an uproar. And Senator Kennedy said, "Don't you dare say anything about Birch Bayh." This is why. Because Birch Bayh and his wife and Kennedy and his wife had been in an airplane crash together. Other people died in that crash. Birch Bayh pulled Kennedy and his wife out to safety and flagged down some people to help him. And ever since then, even if they had political disagreements, he was always on his side. It's a fascinating story, Birch Bayh, a guy from Indiana. And to top it off, when he finally did lose his election, he lost to Dan Quayle, who later on became our vice president. I just think it's fascinating when we know our history and we know the people who put us where we are.
It's beyond fascinating, beyond fascinating. You know, years ago, I remember trying to make a point to my students that we have a young country, but we have to understand the history behind it, right? So to make the point, I was telling them some stories about three Civil War veterans who were still alive when I was born. They were real old, they were over 100. And I remember students, it backfired. They said, "My God, Dr. Rubichek, how old are you? My God." And I said, "I was so old that when I was in school that we didn't have any history," you know, trying to be a little sarcastic. God, these stories are fabulous. I really, really love these stories. Sometimes I say that to guests, I like them, I tell him I love him, but I love yours. So I love yours. These are incredible.
I appreciate that.
And you know, in a lot of the history we share together, I knew Allison Krauss, for example, at Kent State. Mm-hmm. I graduated high school in 1970, started college in 1970, worked for McGovern in 72. You get the idea. I have a feeling that we're probably days from each other being born. Okay.
Yeah.
So we gotta share that. History is really personalized in this next story about your grandmother. It's also a story that's included in your new book, Make a Point to Tell a Story. Tell us a story. We're looking forward to this one.
Well, I don't like to read, but this one I want to read it to you because it's in the book and it's short. Even though, please, to tell you the truth, since it's about my grandmother, I definitely know it by heart. But it's story number 15. The book is called Make a Point, Tell a Story, because I've learned that every story should have a point. And if you want to make a point, the best way to do it is with the story. So story 50, a well-lived miracle. Beginning with her birth, my grandmother's life was a well-lived miracle. The times in which she lived were very challenging, but she lived long and left an impressive legacy. That is a miracle. Mama Jessie, as we called my grandmother, was born a few minutes after midnight on February 14th, 1900. Her twin sister had been born minutes earlier on February 13th, 1900. Twins with different birthdays. It was a miracle for them to survive in 1900. In 1900, 30% of all deaths were the deaths of children. 165 of every 1,000 children died before the age of five. So just being born and making it to age five was a miracle because the odds were not in the child's favor. The top killers in 1900 were infectious diseases, tuberculosis, influenza, and pneumonia. Due to the lack of sanitation and regulation, these diseases were rampant. Every family, rich and poor, experienced the death of a child. It was so prevalent that there was a name for it. It was called the empty chair syndrome. So for Mama Jessie and Aunt Essie, surviving childhood was a big deal, but there was so much more to come. While they were teenagers, the country would enter World War I. And by the time they were 18, the world was experiencing the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. Can you imagine? Up until then, there had been no world wars. Wars, yes, but not wars that included most of the major countries of the world. There had always been epidemics and infectious diseases, but not in recent memory had there been such a deadly pandemic. Millions of people died during World War I, but more soldiers died from that flu than from battle. At that time, the world didn't understand germs and viruses as we do now, so they were terrified of the silent killer. So as a teenager, my grandmother was dealing with war, quarantines, and a pandemic. Well, by the time my grandmother had reached the age of 29, the roaring 20s were over. She had just lived through the racial strife of that decade that began with the Red Summer in 1921. During those years, Blacks were terrorized and many Black towns were destroyed. For Blacks and my grandmother, the 20s weren't so roaring. Then she experienced the stock market crash in 1929. Her 30s were spent during the Depression, which was a tough time for everyone. She learned to do without and to make do. By the time she reached her 40s, the country was involved in the Second World War. Unlike the majority of women who were just entering the workforce in the 40s, my grandmother had always worked. She worked hard and would eventually have her own business. A lot happened in America from 1900 to 1945, and all this would happen before my grandmother was 45 years old. And she wasn't even supposed to live that long. In 1900, the life expectancy for white men was 46.6 years. For non-white men, it was 43.5 years. For white women, it was 48.7 years. And for non-white women, it was 33.5 years. So my grandmother and aunt were doing good if they made it to age 34. Aunt Essie, Mama Jessie's twin, she died in November 1942. Reaching the age of 42 wasn't that bad. It was 9 years more than expected. But family stories always tell how Aunt Essie didn't have the healthiest of habits. She drank and smoked, but Mama Jessie, she didn't do any of that. After her twin sister died, Mama Jessie still had four major wars and 10 recessions yet to live through, 55 more years. By the 1950s, Mama Jessie was a grandmother and had been married a couple of times. Her husbands were soldiers who fought in World War II and in the Korean War. The wars never did seem to end. In the 1960s, there were numerous political assassinations and social upheaval in the country. But it wasn't until 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, when my grandmother was 65, that she was guaranteed the right to vote. And she still had more than 30 years left to live. In my 60 plus years, I've seen a lot of turmoil and a lot of change. I've seen this country go through ups and downs, but I probably haven't seen as much as my grandmother saw. I know my life hasn't been as easier than hers. I know that I benefit greatly from social changes, technological advances, and unearned good luck. I also know that there is a lot more change I'd like to see in the world. I hope to have my grandmother's strength. That is a strength that will get me through the rough times. She's a great example of that. Just the memory of her life and what she endured inspires me. I also have my grandmother's prayers. So many times things go my way and I know it must be because my grandmother prayed for me. I know throughout her life, she prayed for her offspring to see a better world and I benefit from those prayers. Finally, I'm glad I got my grandmother's genes. If she can double her life expectancy, maybe I can follow her example and double mine. It will take all my strength and my courage. I will have to have healthy habits and be smart. Like my grandmother, my life can be a miracle, a life well lived. I just have to keep it all in perspective.
Wow. Your book is a compilation of these kind of stories, right?
Yes. So there's 50 different stories and they're all like short stories, 2 to 3 pages long. So,
yeah. Wow. You know. And are they fueled mostly from by family experience?
Personal and history. The majority is probably personal type stuff in history. But the main thing is they always have a point.
They really do.
Yeah.
And even though it's relatively obvious, what is the point of this story that you just shared with us?
That my grandmother lived a heck of a life, and we all can live a heck of a life. And even with all the ups and downs through all of that, you know, my grandmother was a domestic servant. She cleaned homes, but she had her own business. And before she died, she served people like presidents and generals. Colin Powell was one of her closest friends, and she served his birthday party. She's a great person, and those people that can make it that long and go through all of those trials and tribulations. And we fuss about a little bit of war, a little bit of inflation, a little bit of this, that, and the other.
Right,
if you go
from
1900 to 1990s, you know. Yeah.
Well, our lives really do parallel each other. As a lot of listeners know, I'm a second generation survivor. My grandmother and mother was in Sudhof concentration camp. They were on a death march and darted out of line and saved their own lives. And my grandfather was in Dachau. And of course, growing up with them, we all lived in the same house. Mm-hmm. The stories about their obstacles were overwhelming. They were just overwhelming, almost to the extent that they were suffocating me. But what I realized later on is that somehow, some way, they won, they lived, they benefited from these, what we would oftentimes refer to as obstacle. For them, these were just anecdotes of strength. And I find those fascinating. You said that your grandson lives with you, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Does he ever ask you to tell him stories?
Oh, yeah. He's
good.
If anybody I'd give a shout out to, he'd be the one, because he's got a sympathetic ear for my stories.
Oh, good.
And it goes along with helping with the school. I think our teachers would be a lot better if they would tell more stories. So I try to tell stories even with that.
I was thinking about that when you were telling your stories earlier, your historical stories. I wish I had a history teacher who did that. I would like it a lot more. I loved history, too. But it wasn't so much because of the teachers. I was just fascinated by it.
But you know, Hank, if you like stories, you know, and you like school, you know, I have a kid that I mentor, and he had a bunch of homework about triangles. I didn't know nothing about that, but I could do the research and digging and find out that, oh, we're talking about trigonometry. Right. And trigonometry is just understanding that, you know, A squared, B squared equals C squared. But the stories that you can build around that, because it's through knowing trigonometry that we navigate the oceans, you know? That gets you to Columbus stories and all kinds of stories. So to me, most everything I learned in school, if they could somehow attach it to that kind of a story, it would probably stick a little bit better.
You're so right. The power of story spoken so well. Yeah, you're really perpetuating and promoting the power of story, and I appreciate it. That is so true. It is so true. Tell us where to find your book.
You can find it at Amazon.com. You just go out and do a search on my name, Michael Brundy, and my books will pop up. You can also find it on my website. My website is www.storiesbymichael.com. Storiesbymichael.com. And then you'll see a tab say My Book. And from there, you can just go click on that and you can buy it that way. If you get it from my website, you'll get an autographed copy. You get a quick one from Amazon.com. But either way.
Very cool. Very, very cool.
And while you're out on that website, there's tons of other stuff to see. You can see my video stories. You can read my blog. But it's a good place to buy the book. But also, if you like stories, that's a great place to go. That's why it's called Stories by Michael.
Tell us about your business, iSpeak.
iSpeak is all about me publishing books, me going out to speak and tell stories, having blogs. Everything that I do is about me speaking. Like I said in the beginning, I just love communicating. And I came up with that name probably when I first heard names like iPod and that. So I said, I speak.
Right,
okay.
Right. All right. iPad. I speak.
Yep.
You
know. I'm blessed that I'm retired from working, so I get a chance to speak and do little jobs all around here, and that's
right.
Really cool.
That's the main thing. That's the main reason to be retired, to do fun things, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Very. That's wonderful. That is great. Who was the storyteller in your home growing up? I feel like it was your grandmother, but
Well, now in the house when I was growing up, kids kept their mouths shut and just listened. So we didn't get a chance to say a whole lot. So you'd hear a whole, and stories were really just the conversations that people have. Some of the best ones I remember, though, even were, of course, the ministers of the church. They come up with some great stories. Sometimes they're repetitive, so you really get a chance to know those stories. But at the barbershop, man, I would get the greatest of stories. I think I mentioned earlier that at our barbershop, we just had these guys who, when we knew them, they weren't famous. They were just on their way in the military, on their way going up to be a major, a general, or whatever. And later on, they turned out to be Colin Powell or the professor, you know, the professor or the president at Prairie View College or someone like that. But back in those days, they would always be telling me stories about what I could be doing with my life and how I could achieve. That's what got me interested in the ROTC. That's what got me interested into the military. If it hadn't been for all that crazy stuff, I'd have been just like my father and all the other men, and I'd have been doing just that. But most of the stories, the better stories, probably came from the barbershop.
Yeah. I love it. In about 30 seconds, convey an inspirational message for so we can remember you. If you had to give us, because you know you give inspirational talks. So if you could give us a short 30-second, you know, not elevator speech, but an inspirational message. So we think about it and we think of Michael Grundy. What would that be?
Well, my favorite thing is I always say that you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. I've just learned that, you know, it's our perspective and how you look at stuff, whether it's failure or success, that makes such a big difference. And I learned that you look at failure differently. You look at failure as a stepping stone, as a learning. I always say, don't give up. You know, I heard as a kid, quitters never win and winners never quit.
Right.
Everything I ever succeeded at, I failed at first. I failed at speaking first. I failed at wrestling first. I failed at running marathons first. Everything I succeeded at, I failed at. And so I've learned that, you know, that failure really is just like a signal to say, hey, something's coming around the corner. It's getting better if you stick to it. So never give up and change the way you look at things.
Yeah, that's a great message. Yeah, I always, you know, my anecdote to life is if you do what's right, you'll never be wrong, you know, kind of like that, you know, okay,
yeah, like
if you
that.
Make mistakes, but in your heart, if you know what's right, you're never going to be wrong.
Yep.
In her book, Storycatcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story, Christina Baldwin reinforces this point metaphorically. Something is happening in the moment. Something is happening in our story, and we don't yet know it. We're just in it. We live in story like a fish lives in water. We swim through words and images, siphoning story through our minds the way a fish siphons water through its gills. Our experiences, the anecdotes, our philosophies are really best told in story form. When they're in story form, they're listenable. They engage. They let us know that we are worth listening to because we're being told something memorable. It's a gift. So I encourage listeners all the time, get involved in stories. You know, there's always a reason to celebrate stories. There's always a reason to tell them. Birthdays, all kinds of celebrations. One of the greatest gifts, sit around and tell your family a story. Michael, you proved that the power of story is a gift inherently given to us all. We just need to decide what to do about it. Thank you so much, my friend, Michael Grundy, for blending history and inspiration into a unique style of personal narrative. Storytellers let listeners through windows of their souls. That's the power of story. Never doubt it. Remember, September 28th, we are moving to Wednesdays at 6 o'clock. Promos will remind you, so we know you listen in all the time. So please do and be reminded of that. But in the meantime, don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a very cool mix of soul. Make Houston's community station KPFT 90.1 a part of every day. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and on behalf of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean that you can't live happily ever after. Peace.
Relevant talk, information, and great music. This is Community Media, KPFT.
On March 27th, 2020, KPFT closed its studios due to COVID. We've been producing and broadcasting programs that were prepared from home by all of our 200-plus volunteer DJs. Well, all that's about to change. The Caroline Street Studio will open this Saturday, September 24th at noon for a special broadcast for 6 hours, and then we will resume, in part, live broadcast going forward. There's a new schedule. Check out kpft.org for details, and tune in this Saturday at noon for this 6-hour, very special broadcast as Community Media returns live to the airwaves. Looking forward to hearing you, looking forward to seeing you. Community Media, your friends and neighbors, bringing you the best in Houston, Texas. This is KPFT-FM, FM-HD1, Houston.
Hello, KPFT listeners. It's Tom Tranchilla with Songwriter Studio. Join us every Sunday at 5 to 6 p.m. right after Howlin' the Blues. We bring you local, regional, and national artist interviews and their new release albums right here on KPFT.
She lit you in her house. If you come knocking late at night, she lit you in her mouth. If the words you say are right, if you pay the price, she lit you deep inside. There's a secret garden she has. She'll let you in her car to go driving around. She'll let you into the parts of herself that'll bring. She'll let you in her heart. If you got a hammer in a vice, but into a secret garden, don't think twice. You've gone a million miles. How far? That place where you can't remember and you can't forget. She'll lead you down the path. There'll be tenderness in the air. She'll let you come just far enough so you know she's really. She'll look at you and smile, and her eyes will say, she's got a secret garden where everything you want, where everything.